Studio 360.
Jamie Harrison is one of the two founders and directors of a remarkable theater company in Scotland called Vox Motus. They make these fabulous theater pieces using all sorts of gadgetry and puppets and effects, which is why he was hired to create all the onstage illusions for the new $68 million Broadway show Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, which just opened. But Jamie Harrison's latest passion project is something on a much, much, much smaller scale. A few years ago, he and his Vox Motus co-artistic director, Candace Edmonds, came across this novel called Hinterland that they knew they had to adapt for the stage. The novel is about two young brothers, Ariane and Kabir, orphaned refugees from Afghanistan who embark on this harrowing journey west, thousands of miles across the Middle East and Europe, heading for the UK to try to start new lives. Their idea was to present the entire story using hundreds of tiny models inside little dioramas. The result is an amazing, one-of-a-kind show called Flight. If you can call it a show, it's almost more a museum art installation than theater. Picture it like a merry-go-round with the two dozen booths surrounding it stationary. As I'm sitting there alone in the dark, this little diorama, no bigger than a shoebox, passes in front of me and lights up. And then another diorama lights up, and I'm hearing the dialogue from the tiny little figurine characters depicted in each scene, maybe talking about the tiny apples they're picking or the tiny phone they're about to make a call on. Anyhow, I was fascinated about what went into this production, so I went with my producer, Evan Chung, to a performance of Flight at the McKittrick Hotel, a theater venue in New York, to talk with Jamie Harrison about his production. What we're looking at here is one little 10 by 10 inch plexiglass window with the two main characters. Oh, no window. So I could have grabbed them.
You could grab them. That was part of what we wanted to achieve, actually, that we wanted the audience to feel like they could reach out and touch each of the characters. It's just something about that fragility that was beautiful and that we wanted to use in the storytelling of these two brothers traveling across the world.
In his pockets, Ariane has one plastic wallet, $2,000, one red mobile phone without SIM, one tiny book of Afghan poetry. Kabir has nothing in his pockets except dreams. He dreams of amazing adventures, impossible futures. He dreams of flight.
Sometimes I feel guilty saying this, but I'll be honest with you. When we were thinking about making this show, we had a horrible moment when we sat and we thought, do people actually want to buy tickets for this story? Because it's in the news all the time. It's so harrowing and it's so difficult for us and for society to try to work out the right way forward. And it was one of those moments where you sit and you think, actually, no, we've got to tell this story. What is the point of being a theatre maker and, you know, having these skills unless you use them for something purposeful? And that was actually part of the reason we decided to sort of tell this story using the carousel and to use miniatures. I feel like we've achieved what we set out to do, because a lot of people say, we came to see it because people said it was cool and we couldn't stop crying at the end. And for me, that I couldn't have dreamt of a better outcome for the project.
And it's such an epic story, these two brothers going halfway around the world to live and escape and be free, and that counterpoint to this tiny little it is not, in no way is it physically epic, obviously it's the opposite.
Obviously everything is in miniature, everything is tiny, but we're really interested in the relationship between the observer sitting in a booth and feeling almost godlike. It makes, you know, these tiny characters, some of them are, you know, 6 millimeters high. And what that does in terms of our relationship to the characters and what we might feel about our power relationship to who they are and who they are in the world and what we can do about it.
Hurry up, Kabir. So tell me where we're going.
We're going to school so I can learn to be a world-famous singer and rock guitarist. Also a chef.
Fantastic. And where is this amazing school that will teach us all these things?
London.
Where is that?
England, Europe, the world.
But like here, this... I have always had a fondness for dollhouses and all that kind of thing. This is, it's so, each one is so extraordinary. As you're listening to the story and getting the music and the lighting cues and all that, but just this guy sitting on a bed in a window beyond a sort of decrepit wall. Mm-hmm. There are so many different details in each one. And there are hundreds of these, right?
Well, there are literally thousands of individual objects. There's, I think it's 900... characters. The thing I think people really respond to, and the thing that I'm really proud of, is the tangible, handcrafted skill that has gone into it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what people love about theater experiences as well. You know, you're in the room with the actors who are offering something to you, and here, although they're not live actors, it's an offering of thousands of hours of work and dedication, and you know, hand making. All these little oranges on these trees were handmade and hand painted and hand glued into position with a tiny little set of tweezers. And I think that's part of the attraction of a doll's house. You know, you can imagine the work that has gone into it. And so to see 230 of them tell you a story that we hope is moving and interesting to a contemporary viewer I'm really proud of it.
Like here, there is a crate of oranges. It's just I can't say enough how gorgeously done, executed each one is, and how they go. It almost goes by too fast.
Yeah, people have said that.
To come back and see it a second time, just with stop action.
That was something I was worried about when we were making it. That we were all worried about was rhythm. That, you know, we've got this constant speed of the carousel, and is it going to send the audience to sleep because of its lulling? You know, you're sitting in a dark booth in a warm room with headsets on, and so we worked really hard to play, to work against that, and make sure that the rhythms could change. And in some ways, it's a little bit like making what I imagine it'd be like to make a film or a TV program. Because of the width of the booth, there's only a certain amount of time that you have with each box before it travels past the booth. And so the size of the box dictates how long it can be lit for, because you don't want it lit in the booth beside. So a big box can only be lit for a very short amount of time before it moves past you.
Because what we're seeing here, what each person sees, is only a couple of feet across.
Yeah, exactly. And so for moments when we wanted to pick up the rhythm of the piece, we had to make the boxes smaller and make the models inside much smaller, so that we could have many boxes lighting up quickly.
Uh-huh.
And for the moments when we wanted to sort of...
So it's like you're cutting quickly if you were making a film.
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of like a film process.
Working that out, the lighting cues, uh-huh. Meanwhile, the voiceover uh-huh. of the actors is going in your head, music. Uh-huh. The process of getting that right must have been... difficult.
Immense. And I'll tell you something. Our lighting designer, Simon Wilkinson, who's a long-term collaborator of ours, he actually has a previous life as a software programmer, and he's worked for all kinds of big companies like Apple. And he had to actually write software for us, because not only are all the cues for the lighting and the sound and all has to be tied into the exact position of the carousel, but that is happening 25 times around the booth, because there are 25 people watching, but each offset slightly. And there was no software out there in the theatre world, because the theatre world's software is used to just running one show at a time, whereas we're running 25 shows at a time. So Simon wrote software to allow the show to run smoothly, and for each box to know exactly where the carousel is at that point, so that they don't move out of sequence at any point in time. I mean, it's lovely, because people come in and they think of it as a really sort of artisanal piece.
I was just going to say, it's so lo-fi, and you can touch it, and it's pre-digital, but it is digitally.
But actually, we've got 7 computers through there running this thing.
Yeah.
And also, there were 2 digital artists working on it as well. A wonderful guy called Sav Skatola, that we work with quite a lot, who created the boys' faces first, so that we could 3D print the boys themselves, the characters of the boys. So Candice and I went through a directing process digitally, looking at these images of the boys on the screen and asking Sav, it doesn't feel quite like he's, has the right attitude at this point. Can we hunch his shoulders? Can we drop his head? Can his left eyebrow And what that allowed us to do was to 3D print the boys. Everything else is handmade sort of from scratch.
So what, when I'm looking here at the two boys talking to a guy, so their faces or their whole bodies were digitally printed?
Their whole bodies are digitally printed, but everything else that you see around them is handmade from
model making. But 3D printed them?
3D printed.
Really?
Yeah. I'll be honest, we had quite a few misprints where we'd accidentally printed the wrong character for the wrong box and they turned up. And, you know, of course, it was an arts project, so we were very tight on money and we had to be creative at some point. Actually, this is one of the moments when we had to be quite creative.
Describe what's going on here.
So this is Kabir, who's lying in bed.
And it's a bird's eye view.
It's a bird's eye view, and it's him on his own because we're at that point in the story, we're dreaming with him. And then we cut to a scene where the sun is starting to come up, the light is shining in through the window. And what you can't actually see here is that's the wrong model.
Oh, really?
And so what we did was we chopped his legs off, rearranged the body, and put a blanket over it. Yeah. So you can, I shouldn't really be saying
that would be
this,
harder to do with the actors.
Yeah, it would be a lot.
Have you ever done this one-on-one theater?
No, never. I'd never done it myself. But we had seen some sort of performance art pieces where you were maybe, you know, taken into a cubicle or you'd be taken into a cupboard.
Yes.
And so we knew that that could be a very intimate and immersive experience, but no, we hadn't done it ourselves.
Right. The only other thing it reminded me of is in the 19th century, you must know of these things where they would have these many yards long murals and they would unroll them slowly for an audience as you floated down the Mississippi.
Yeah,
it's
kind
of like that.
It's do you know, it was... my magic background sometimes plays into this. I spent a lot of time reading books about
a magician is what you were before you became a theater maker.
Yeah, exactly. And as a result, I'm one of those geeky people who spends lots of time flicking through old Victorian books. And I think that it was a big sort of influence in particularly in this piece. We've called this a narrative dioramascope in honor of those Victorian...
Yes. You trademarked that phrase yet?
Not yet. There's a back catalogue of brilliant Victorian inventions to look at and evolve and rework. And what I always try to do is to sort of take those ideas but do it differently.
That were done in stage magic 150 years ago. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, I get quite often get into a conversation about how, oh, it's such a new thing, you know, seeing all this magic in the theatre, and actually it really isn't. The Victorians have done it all before. Some of the things they were doing on stages.
Lots of glass and mirrors and, right.
And they had horses galloping on stage and, you know, the horse races on these huge turntables and people emerging from these incredible trapdoors that would revolve the person around as it traversed across the stage and then somebody could walk over it straight away and, you know, these incredible ideas. And I find that period very, it's really inspiring when you look at the ingenious, there was almost a sort of an arms race for who could do the best effects over that period. And a lot of them have vanished. You know, we can't do them
good
anymore.
For you.
So
now you look like a genius, even more than you are a genius.
No.
Flight just closed after its run in New York, but Vox Modus calls itself a touring theater company for a reason. So check back at their website to see where Flight lands next.